Hello, welcome to Wheat from the Chaff. I'm Finlow Costain, the editor-in-chief of 8.9.com.
And I'm Phil Carson, the UK policy lead for the Nature Friendly Farming Network.
Well, Phil, it's nearly the end of the year. It's Christmas, it's the festive season, and so it seems like, well, everybody else is having Christmas parties, and it's quite difficult to do between the two of us, but I feel like we should give it a go.
Oh, we should. We have to do it.
You've got a glass of wine on your side. I don't know how this works through the internet, but let's give it a go. I've got a glass of wine. Cheers.
Cheers.
And that seemed to work quite well. If you can grab the other end of this cracker as well, and we'll see how this goes.
Oh, hey.
There we go. Let's have a look, see what's inside. Let's see if the joke is suitable. It says, why couldn't the skeleton go to the Christmas party? Because he had no body to go with. Let's see, you pay for class here. These are more like Halloween crackers than Christmas crackers. But what do you do if you really love vampires?
Tell me.
You join a fan club. There we go. If you can put your Christmas hat on.
Thank you
amazing.
Very much. I'd say exact same for you as well. Lovely bright green.
And you've got that beautiful yellow. There we go. Right, well, we've learned that we can pull a cracker through Zoom, which is the first thing.
Yeah, I think that's the first time anyone has ever managed to do that successfully. So we should pat ourselves in the back for that.
Absolutely. It's a bit of Christmas magic. But I think, you know, we've covered an awful lot of topics. I think we've learned a little bit about doing podcasts together. I think 2 weeks ago, we did quite a tight podcast. We got a bit sloppy again last week. We're going to try and be tighter today.
Yeah, I think we overestimated our abilities and we were riding high on a very quick, efficient, snappy podcast from the week before. And then we went into a little bit of a trudge.
Yeah, well, okay, we'll stop wittering. Let's get on with it.
Let's go.
Okay, so the first story, without further ado, tree equity map shows less affluent areas have got lower tree cover. Phil, this is a story that came up. It's from the Woodland Trust. They've employed a sequence of research that was used in the USA, first of all, and they've brought it over to the UK, and they've essentially mapped different areas, different postcodes of the United Kingdom to see where that greatest tree coverage is, and then to look at a few other things as well.
It shines in pretty harsh detail disparities in terms of health outcomes, and that's something I suppose we discussed on the podcast before, both in terms of dietary related ill health and various different other things, but also the importance of tree cover in addressing issues such as air pollution, yet overcoming I suppose the urban heat island effect, things like that, and demonstrating I suppose just how important woodland and woodland cover can be in urban areas. And some of the figures are pretty astounding, really. So, for example, the areas that have the highest level of tree cover have up to 330% less air pollution and 4 degrees lower temperatures than other neighbourhoods where tree canopy cover is lowest. That's pretty astounding. And at scale, I think that can have quite a big impact on, I suppose, personal well-being, personal health, all that sort of stuff.
As you say, there's those ecological benefits of street trees and other sort of tree island areas in town squares and parks, but also that kind of mental health and physical health element as well. And I wonder why it is that this has arisen, whether it's that generally speaking in those wealthier areas, the houses are bigger, they're more likely to have gardens, they're more likely to preserve the squares. And perhaps in those poorer areas, town planners just haven't prioritised these things. They've just prioritised infrastructure and people are just living more cheek by jowl.
I'd agree with that. Even Belfast, which has been referenced in here as a city that is trying to lead the way with developing more even proportions in terms of tree equity, and there's a commitment to plant millions of trees within the city by 2030. But you go to some areas where you would say they're less affluent and there's barely a tree on the street, and you can feel how much hotter it is on a warm day. You can compare that to somewhere which is maybe 5-10 minutes walk away, because it's a very highly concentrated city, and it is quite stark, and you can feel it, you can see it. Yeah, it's something that I think planners and councillors have to get a grip of, because integrating these things into cities are going to ultimately result in lower costs that have to be borne by these institutions, essentially.
Right, next story.
Yes, next story is the outcome of the review of Dartmoor and the attempts to move towards a favourable condition for the triple SIs, the SACs that are found within the national park. And just to give a little bit of context on this, there was a highly contentious debate and row, I suppose, between some of the landowners and commoners on Dartmoor and essentially Natural England around the renewal of higher level stewardship agreements, which are agri-environment agreements. The HLS agreements for Dartmoor, which had been signed by, I suppose, commoners organisations over 10 years ago, were coming to an end. And the status of the site in general wasn't improving compared to what was expected. In some cases, it actually declined. And as, I suppose, an organisation with a responsibility to ensure that SSSIs are in favourable condition, Natural England wanted to revisit and change the prescriptions within the agreements. This led to quite a polarised debate in terms of how land management would be shaped within the national park.
And that polarisation remains, not to interrupt for very long, but just that polarisation still remains by all accounts. And Phil Stocker from the National Sheep Association, that sort of we're focused around for this article, is talking about that relationship having broken down. And clearly there is a real need to repair that as a priority going forwards.
Indeed. And a large focus of the debate, I suppose, centred on stocking rates and management prescriptions for some of the semi-natural habitats found within the national park, and the costs of managing those habitats, getting grazing right at different parts of the year. So there's areas that were experiencing undergrazing, for example. There was others that were experiencing overgrazing, but there was whole considerations really in terms of grazing at certain times of the year, the ability to move stock off the site, where they go at different times of the year and where they're held, all sorts of things which incur costs and require quite a lot of thought. And I suppose there was accusations around Natural England's approach and some criticisms that they were being particularly heavy-handed and not understanding, I suppose, the wider system. To cut a long story short, the review, which was led by David Thurston, has published its recommendations, and there's quite a broad suite of different recommendations within that, which are intended to bring the site into better condition, to make sure that it functions better for nature, for climate, for the farm communities which use it as well. But it also points at the need for additional resourcing for Natural England, for example, and a whole range of different other things.
Absolutely. British Sugar fails to deliver on 3-year plan to end the use of banned neonicotinoids. Now, this is an application from the sugar industry for the use of banned bee-harming neonicotinoid on sugar beet seed in 2024. This has been submitted to the UK government despite an industry commitment to end reliance on the banned pesticide in 2023. And this is an article responding to news coming out of the Wildlife Trust. And actually, Sue Pritchard from the Food Farming and Countryside Commission goes slightly further. She says British Sugar has actually had 13 years notice to work with their farmers to plan for alternatives. And she points out they made a 1.4 billion profit this year and are currently in dispute with farmers over the beet contract price. She says, this isn't science, this is greed. And I guess here we have a challenge, don't we? We have an industry that urgently needs to become less reliant on chemicals, but we also have an industry which is contributing to some pretty harsh ills in society. And last week we were talking about the fact that between 3/4 of Britons between 45 and 74 are now overweight or obese, with a cost to the UK economy of £98 billion a year. So the question is whether we should really be continuing with a sugar industry at the scale that it is at all, or whether we shouldn't be finding ways, or government shouldn't be finding ways to scale that industry back, and that they shouldn't be working with farmers that are currently producing sugar beet to help them transition their businesses so they're able to produce other crops, potentially make more money, but out of healthier foodstuffs.
There's very, very valid arguments within all of that. And we spoke a little bit, or quite a lot, last week around the external costs of our current food system. And yeah, there's quite a lot of external costs here in relation to one specific industry within that. And I think to be successful in terms of what you've articulated there, we need to see more action on the likes of dietary health, that obesity strategy that we spoke about before, and really starting to interrogate whether it's pragmatic or it makes sense to be focusing on a sector which, yeah, is incurring quite significant costs. Is it really sustainable in the long term to be continuously applying for a derogation? I don't think that's a sustainable future. And I think in the short term, there's about a third of farmers that are growing sugar beet at the moment which aren't reliant on neonics at all. What sort of strategies are they employing? How can the private sector and I suppose the supply chain support that sort of knowledge exchange and that knowledge and learning for more to kind of adopt those practices? But ultimately, yeah, there's big questions in the long term around a lot of this.
And just to be clear, I'm not being anti-sugar. I've got a real sweet tooth. I love chocolate and jelly sweets. I mean, a whole range in between. But the reality is I eat too many of them, but society is clearly consuming too much sugar. We need a farming industry, a food system, which is not only working for farmers, not only working for businesses, but it is working for society and working for ecology. And it's reconnecting these various dots that's necessary. And as you say, it requires a much more joined up approach by government, but also, perhaps a more joined up approach on the ground as well. Phil, last story of this sort of short roundup before the big conversations.
Yes. So the next story is the publication of a new white paper from Organic Farmers and Growers, OF&G for short, which is really advocating for a shift to organic farming, or 10% of England's land to be farmed organically, and how that can deliver a range of I suppose, the government's objectives, essentially. So it talks about how a threefold increase in organic land use would reduce agricultural greenhouse gas emissions, it would help to increase carbon sequestration, and then it would also result in a reduced amount of artificial nitrogen fertilizer being used as well. So it's really extolling the benefits of an increase in the area of organic land within England, which actually is lower than what has been committed to across the European Union, for example, which is quite interesting in that respect.
Which is all very well. The thing that disappointed me a little bit about this report was the lack of context in terms of the way that it was presented. You would expect an organic organisation certification body to say that they want to see more organic production. And, you know, there's no dispute that organic production is a good thing. But I think there's been such a rise over the last few years in terms of agroecology and regenerative agriculture in particular, I would have expected to see some contextualisation. And I think it's important to sort of say that there are different routes to market for different types of producers. And so you will have people, you know, working for First Milk, for example, or working, you know, for a Nestle contract, who are trying to transition to regenerative or are already regenerative, but they don't need a certificate to prove that they are that, because they're already producing within the conditions of that contract. And it's up to the company, you know, at the top to demonstrate that to their customers. In the same way, if you're a farmer who's selling directly to the public, perhaps for a farm shop or through the internet, then you build up that relationship and you don't need that certification. So organic certification needs to understand where it sits within that market. And certainly a lot of the farmers that I know who are organic, you know, they go way beyond what is required, but they are still being certified because that is a clear route to market and means that they can add the value to that product in the markets they're selling into.
Exactly. And there's questions here in relation to why we haven't seen a growth in organic farming within England in the last 10, 20 years or so. It's stayed relatively static over that period of time. So what are the questions?
And relatively small, it has to be.
Yeah, I think it's around 3% of our land area or farm businesses are certified as organic. And that is considerably less than other parts of Europe, for example. And is that a question of, the potential market? Or is it a question of government inaction in this space? So I know, for example, Denmark have done quite a lot in terms of food procurement and how that can stimulate increased interest and production of organic food. Are there creative ideas that we can adopt? All those sorts of things. And what's the strategy behind it, essentially? We know what the benefits potentially are. What is the strategy in terms of the long term around that?
Let's take a break. We We're going to talk in this section about COP28, and that's going to take us through a conversation about carbon and perhaps carbon tunnel vision towards a conversation about natural capital and nature as infrastructure. Perhaps, Phil, you could start us off with your thoughts and reflections on COP28.
Yes. So this year, as with every conference of the parties, there's been a range of different announcements that have been put forward by private institutions, by nations, by all sorts of actors within this space. And it's hard to make sense of whether we've ended up in a better place than what we'd originally hoped, or whether we're in a far worse situation than originally anticipated. Looking at it, I think there's lots of commentators on various different sides of the debate, some saying that COP in the United Arab Emirates has been an absolute disaster. Some who are cautiously optimistic. We've seen commitments on fossil fuels, for example. They've been put into global text for the first time in this space. We've also seen some action on food systems as well, the first time that those have been recognised. And I think it's worth having a bit of a conversation around where we actually are within this. So we have Kevin Anderson, who is a highly respected voice within the climate debate, very, very switched on, very, very, very vocal on a lot of these issues. And I've been watching what he's had to say with quite close interest over the last few weeks. And at the end of the COP process, at the end of COP28, this is what he had to say. So this so demonstrates the level of failure at COP28, underpinned by IPCC scenarios, to address the central issue of decent policy making today. Instead, we get fingers crossed for billions of tons of carbon sucking tech tomorrow and future electric jets for the fortunate few.
And of course, we also need to bear in mind that this is working on the basis that everybody who commits to something at COP is actually going to deliver what they say. And that's always been the kicker, that people commit to things, but then they don't have the mechanisms in place or the authority as a government in order to be able to deliver the commitments that they have made during the process itself. And it seems to me that there are different processes going on. And what Kevin Anderson, of course, is talking about, what the COP process is about, is a government process. There is a process of global leadership trying to work out what to do and how to assist that transition. But underneath that, or separate from that, you have a business process. And within that, you have this discussion about fossil fuels. You have people trying to eliminate, trying to work out whether they should be focusing on emissions or focusing on eliminating fossil fuels from their business strategies. And then you have these technical processes, as you were talking about there, an awful lot of reliance on technical solutions. And within that, we have this emerging agroecological process where there are more and more people talking about the value and the opportunity of agroecology. And then aside from that, again, you have the societal process. And it's very hard to tell, you know, how that sits in the world. But from a UK perspective, we've clearly seen a little bit of rowing back. There is a general acceptance that climate change is a clear and present danger, but there have been moves taken by the government to sort of fuel a bit of the populism and the idea that, well, it's coming, but, you know, we'll cope. And it's not going to be so bad as we really need to change our way of life.
And just continuing on the vein of Kevin Anderson's work, I was nerding out a little bit last night in preparation for this, and I found quite a large review that him and a range of other voices in this space put together, really interrogating why we haven't seen any tangible actions to reduce emissions over the last 30 years, despite the fact that we've had a number of different Conference of the Party sessions within that time. And it makes the case that there's this really common and strong thread that's kind of paramount and running throughout all of them. And it's all about the concentration of power and the kind of hegemonic kind of worldview around how we run our economies, how we kind of measure progress as well. And I think we haven't really departed away from that within this COP as well, which is which is a bit of a challenge and can be, I think, it's a fair challenge to the process in the round.
And then alongside what Kevin Anderson was saying, we had an interview on 8.9.com last week with Patrick Holden, who had been at COP for the full period. And he was just back in the UK. And I was expecting him to be similarly negative. And he seemed actually to be quite upbeat. He was really struck by the fact that there was this sea of tens of thousands of human beings who were all struggling to do the right thing. And I think it's a lovely way of looking at it. And, you know, and stepping back for a moment, yeah, I'm sure that's the case. You have an awful lot of people who are there believing that they are working and doing their best for humanity. But I think, you know, sort of stepping back from what Patrick was saying to an extent, there is still so much disagreement, especially in terms of food systems and land use, about what that right thing to do is. It's so difficult to take Patrick's perspective when you're aware of the polarization that exists in this space, you know, whether we should be focusing on emissions reduction and that's the only game in town, or whether we should be shifting that focus to fossil fuel emissions reduction, which is what I've been arguing in terms of food systems in particular, whether that carbon tunnel vision approach is the most appropriate, or whether we need to move to something which is more holistic, which bears in mind the biodiversity and the desertification elements as well. And I think within that context, it's important to note a report from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, where they're calling for a further intensification of meat production in places like the Netherlands. And, you know, we've spoken before, haven't we, about some of the challenges in the Netherlands around the use of petrochemicals and nitrogen, etc., in order to feed Africa. And it just seems such a contradiction, such a rowback from where we are trying to get to. And instead of this sort of perverse idea, which is just perpetuating the problems that we have, it seems to me. Instead, we need to actively decommodify the global south, and in particular, unlock production from directions from the World Bank and their sort of processes, and instead expand agroecology to build economic and ecosystem resilience.
Yes, the FAO report, I think, is quite problematic for a number of different reasons. And this was all framed around, I suppose, a pathway to 1.5 degrees. So not necessarily net zero. Net zero is a mechanism that we managed to avert any warming beyond 1.5. And to me, looking at it, it recommends, in terms of solutions, strategies that we have employed in the past and which have ultimately failed. And this idea that we have to maximize efficiency and get increasing levels of efficiency and do what we already do well. Let's forget about some of the other issues such as water quality and biodiversity loss, all that sort of stuff. Let's produce efficiently and export to areas which need to see increased livestock protein within their diets. It brings up lots of problematic kind of challenges in terms of, as you say, how those economies develop themselves. Where's the role for kind of food and farming within that? How do they might result into a situation where they're reliant on those exports kind of moving forward? And we've seen examples of milk dumping in the past where we've had coupled subsidies in Europe and those have been exported to other countries, and it's actually suppressed local food economies in those spaces. And then also whenever we're talking about bringing greater power and agency within the conversations within COP from those that have been overlooked and marginalized in the past, the Global South kind of fit within that or should be completely included within that. And I don't know what their perspective would be if they were just taking on a lot of, yeah, highly intensive, highly efficient kind of products from other parts of the world. It doesn't really seem to fit with the recommendations from a lot of very, very kind of preeminent minds in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to sort of help to bring this part of the conversation towards a close, we've been talking about COP28 and the need to understand the context in which climate action exists in relation to business, in relation to the rest of the ecological world, biodiversity and desertification, etc. And I think one of the key things that really needs to be understood, particularly in terms of financial markets, is natural capital. And that brings us to a further story. And this is about I think it's really, it's taking on the work of Dieter Helm from a few years back in the UK, where he was defining nature in terms of natural capital, in terms of its intrinsic value, but also society's ability to monetize some of that value of nature. And this is a report from the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB, which takes that national idea and really talks about trying to apply it on a global scale and set up financial instruments to apply it on a global scale. And so they're proposing defining nature as infrastructure, viewing nature as infrastructure, they say, offers a transformative approach, that it's a process of reconciliation that needs to begin by understanding and recognizing the value that nature can offer us. And our ambition must be to turn the idea of nature as infrastructure from an abstract concept into an impactful asset class that commands increasing levels of investment and regulatory attention. And within that, I'm just going to read out one or two elements from the executive summary of the report. They're talking about infrastructure is traditionally defined as the organizational structures and facilities that allow for the operation of society. And it should now be clear to everyone that nature is an inseparable part of this. They say where nature can provide such infrastructure-like services, that grey infrastructure, so metalwork and concrete, should be carefully considered. Do we even need to have any of that kind of built infrastructure? What can nature provide for us instead? And that investments in nature's restoration should be the norm rather than the exception. And the four areas that they talk about in the report are the need to value nature, looking at nature as infrastructure, building infrastructure to be greener, which is that whole bit about taking out that grey infrastructure and reintroducing the idea that nature can provide these services for humankind. But then it's about building up the finance and markets and other instruments.
Yeah, and do we see in the future that for any sort of infrastructural development, say, for example, that we apply a nature test to it, is there an already made off-the-shelf solution that can do a lot of this stuff? And I think what we're talking about here is the grand kind of extrapolation of what people are seeing on farms and kind of harnessing natural processes, harnessing nature to do things that would otherwise cost you money or would result in, something physical to be built or to be created yourself, or an input that's brought in. It's just really harnessing nature to kind of reduce your reliance on a lot of those other stuff. To counter it, I suppose there's probably the challenge that these big infrastructural developments bring in lots of jobs, bring in lots of money. They're big, big, successful projects, which politicians quite like to tie themselves to. Can we do something similar with kind of nature-based solutions and nature-based infrastructure? I think that's probably something that we need to kind of shift to over time. It's a cultural idea around some of these things.
And when you say the cultural idea, it makes me think about the ethical and the moral elements behind this as well, because I think a lot of people are innately uncomfortable with the idea of commodifying nature, of sort of saying this bit of nature is more valuable than this bit. And from that perspective, I think it's quite helpful just to kind of use an example. And let's use the example of flooding infrastructure, that at the moment, an awful lot of attention is going into concrete flood defences, big metal work, the ability to raise barriers in particular places that has, a really substantial emissions cost. The concrete industry is one of the biggest emitters. There's a really substantial financial cost, as well as the biodiversity cost of implementing these schemes as well. And this is sort of set against the cost of natural flood defences, of natural flood management, where you're carefully working throughout the watershed. And if you get these schemes right, you can scale this up really very rapidly. And I mean, just in terms of cost, you have a very large cost associated with built infrastructure versus a fairly small cost associated with natural flood management. And yes, you're creating jobs through that grey infrastructure, the concrete, the built environment, the construction industry jobs and planning jobs. But with natural flood management, there are lots of jobs associated with that as well. You're keeping farmers farming. You're making sure that you're keeping a stimulated rural economy. You're ensuring that businesses and homes are not flooded and that, there aren't loads of costs there. And you can rapidly deploy this while at the same time reducing, instead of increasing, CO2 emissions and increasing biodiversity. biodiversity regeneration rather than damaging it.
Those are the points that need to be adequately incorporated and recognised whenever we're looking at the feasibility of these two options. And I think quite often they're overlooked. I think another important element within this as well is, yes, you get flood mitigation from both projects, but there's one project within that which does a lot more than that. And you've alluded to it in terms of carbon sequestration, in terms of biodiversity recovery, biodiversity gain, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it makes a lot more sense in terms of value for money. And it's probably on an equal footing in terms of jobs creation and other things, but it's just making sure that that information and that process of weighing up the costs and benefits of each is fair.
And I think at the heart of this is really it's recognising that the knowledge associated with these different sorts of infrastructure, these different ways of achieving the same end, have been developing in parallel, but, you know, like a train line, they've never met. And increasingly today, we're seeing those lines come ever closer together. We're seeing conversations that are starting to join up the knowledge base around this. And so it feels like we are now in a position where we can understand, you know, if we're going to start having a conversation about flooding or about, you know, many other things that are happening in society, then we can ask the question within a team quite reasonably, do we need to do it this way? Can we do it another way? What's the cheapest way in terms of the ecological impact? What's the cheapest way in terms of the economics? And how can we do this most rapidly? And if we're thinking of nature as infrastructure in these terms of protecting us rather than just being simply something that we have to save, as something which is integral to our lives rather than just a nice to have because sparrows like it. I think that changes the conversation.
It does. And that is one thing that's absolutely important and crucial and imperative to kind of hammer home all of the time. Because at the moment, whenever there's a question around changing land use and changing land management, of which doing some of the things that are spoken about within this report, it's going to be quite substantial. And it may result in certain landscapes a rowing back in certain levels of food production or a slightly different focus and might incur significant change. That should be paid for, that should be properly paid for by whoever it is delivering this sort of development. But I think, again, that cultural point and the viewpoint on this is you're not giving up land to save some species, although you might be doing that anyway. You are using your land well to deliver a really important national strategic need. And that is part of the comms around this that I think needs to be pulled up. And I think this fits in with all the stuff that we speak about, future farming policy, future payments, all those sorts of things that needs to be embedded.
And most of the time, you can continue producing fantastic food at the same time. Let's take a break. Phil, this last section is largely about policy, some of it practical, some of it very much embedded within government. The first part of the conversation is an article, Final Consultation Opens for Welsh Sustainable Farming Scheme. Maybe you could talk us through that.
Of course I can. So last week, Welsh Government launched their third and final consultation on the Sustainable Farming Scheme, which will ultimately replace area-based payments in Wales and usher in a new era of sustainable land management. So this consultation is open for a period of 12 weeks and it outlines government's proposals on their scheme and what it will include and how those options will be delivered. So it talks around 17 universal actions which all farmers will have to apply in order to get their sustainable farming scheme payment. And those cover a range of different areas from animal health and welfare, but also looking at managing hedgerows effectively, managing 10% of your land specifically for biodiversity, and 10% of your land for broadleaf woodland as well, with a focus on delivering more nature and climate outcomes. So broadly, this is very, very good to see. It provides a bit more clarity and direction in terms of what Welsh farmers will be expected to do in order to receive public payments in the future. There has been some debate around, I suppose, the requirements to deliver 10% of your land for nature and for woodland as well. But from our perspective at the Nature Friendly Farming Network, we really, really welcomed this consultation. There's more detail required, I suppose, in terms of payment rates that'll be associated with a lot of these actions. and then also where the optional actions fit into place. So we're expecting Sustainable Farming Scheme Universal to be up and running by 2024-25. And then beyond that, we're expecting the optional actions, which will reward more ambitious actions for biodiversity, for climate, for various different other things. Those will be coming into play a little bit later. And we are a little bit concerned that some farmers who are already at that higher level of delivery will be waiting quite some time before there's a scheme that actually rewards them for that.
So is there a danger that those farmers won't be rewarded at all, or just that they won't be rewarded at the higher level?
I think there is a little bit of a danger of both. At the moment, we have seen the pretty poor handling of the transition year from Glasdir, which was the previous agri-environment scheme in Wales, and some farmers who've been right up at the top level of delivering ambitious land management are seeing their payments reduced by up to 97%. So that's quite a considerable income hit from delivering something that was delivering quite a lot of public good and really high quality public goods, to then be waiting 2 or 3 years more for something similar isn't the best thing to be seeing. And there is a risk with scheme design and developing policy that the longer you leave something, and the longer it is to get there.
Yeah, and a 97% hit, I mean, that's devastating. It's not just challenging, it's potentially, life-changing, isn't it?
It's huge.
Farmers in those situations. And I think you're right to bring up Glasdir, because I think, you know, while there are lots of positives around Welsh policy, and that whole farm approach, I think, is important. It's something that, you know, I've been supportive of, and a lot of people have been supportive of throughout that process of thought. There are concerns around the way that things have been put in place, particularly around the process. I think there has been a really poor process at this stage in terms of managing the communications. And I think there are an awful lot of farmers. I think the Welsh Government seems to have squandered a lot of potential goodwill from farmers, particularly around those who are already at those higher levels in terms of ecological production. And the announcement over the summer about the ending of Glasdir before there was anything in place to say, well, this is what's going to replace Glasdir, has just meant that an awful lot of farmers have been looking into a potential financial void, really worried about the future. And at the very least, a better joining up of those communications, a better joining up of policy intentions and directives would have really improved that. And having lost that goodwill, I think the onus is back on Welsh Government now to really, really work hard to build bridges with the farming community, to communicate what those really important outcomes are, what they want to achieve from this policy in order to make sure that they're able to.
I would agree with all of that, and I would say that the challenges which are being witnessed at the moment from a Welsh perspective are being experienced across the UK in many different forms or another. And it's that idea that we need to see as clear as possible a plan for the future to provide that long-term certainty and stability for people to invest, because a lot of the stuff that governments are asking for farmers to do, it is a departure from the status quo. It is going to mean a different change in practice, different change in mindset, and farmers need to be able to prepare for that.
And having criticised Welsh Government, I now want to praise them, because Business Wales is part of is a Welsh Government website, and part of the Business Wales website is Farming Connect. And Farming Connect has some really useful practical articles and information. We covered a couple of them on 8.9 last week to help farmers understand that there is dual economic benefit along with delivering ecological benefit. And so the first of those stories is about grass measuring allowing input costs to reduce by £20,000 for a Welsh dairy farmer.
Pretty astounding, and it just shows the value of informed management in reducing costs and improving profit. And yeah, this isn't an isolated story. It's a really, really good example. But as we know, there's farms up and down the country which are applying similar practices, similar principles, and seeing similar sorts of results. So I think it really shows the potential here. And within that, a lot of the measures that are being spoken about in this article will be complemented by the sustainable farming scheme itself. So again, it really brings forward that economic rationale for investing in these schemes and supporting farmers to adopt them.
And specifically, as a result of the measuring, you know, this gave him the confidence to be able to apply a biological product containing a collection of nitrogen-fixing bacteria instead of granular fertilizer. So it's sprayed onto the grass, converting atmospheric nitrogen and nitrogen from the organic matter into readily available ammonium for the crop. And the farmer was saying, yeah, it's cut his fertilizer bill by $20,000 a year. It's applied at the end of March and the end of June, and it's resulted in no granular fertilizer at all being used on the grazing block over the course of the last 2 years. Also allowed him to reduce his synthetic fertilizer use on the silage ground to 50 kilograms per acre of protected urea and sulfur annually. So that is remarkable. And then the second story that we had was around sheep farming. It was a sheep farmer trialing peas and beans as a soy alternative.
Yep. And again, really, really impressive results here. You're starting to reduce your reliance on imports from other parts of the world. There's a carbon cost associated with that. There's also a biodiversity cost. And yeah, it just contributes towards a more diverse and resilient system as well. And as this piece of work also shows, you're starting to see improvements in terms of live weight gain, in terms of health of the livestock and things like that as well, which are not to be sniffed at.
Yeah, absolutely. And so he's talking in terms here of using bought in peas and beans, you know, for the experiment effectively, and they're being incorporated into the diet of his 600 ewes and 150 Belgian blues. And then in terms of this year, he's expecting to grow his own bicrop so that he can include that in the feed ration next year. It'll fit well, he says, as a break crop in rotation with the 3.6 hectares of barley that he already grows every year. And as peas and beans are a nitrogen fixing crop, it'll mean that he won't need to apply any nitrogen fertilizer to the crop that follows it, and he hopes that their tap roots will be good for the soil structure as well. So all good news, really.
Yeah, multifunctional benefits, if ever there was some.
Absolutely. Just to finish us up, not just for this program but for the year, anything else on policy, Phil?
Yes, so as we speak, if you're listening to this before 11 o'clock on the 19th of December, there is a Westminster Hall debate on the transition to the sustainable farming incentive, which has been secured by Tim Farn, who's been quite vociferous on issues in relation to this area for quite some time. And then we are expecting at the Oxford Farming Conference an announcement on the Agriculture Transition Plan and what the offer for 2024 will look like for the SFI, but also some of the other elements of environmental land management within England as well. So keep an eye out for that. There could be quite a lot of interesting detail within there too.
Thanks so much, Phil. And that brings us to the end, not just of this programme, but as I was saying, to the end of the year. And we will be back, I think, in the second week of January. That's our plan at the moment. And so from me, I think I just need to say Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year. Please do visit 8.9.com. Please do visit the Nature Friendly Farming Network website. And Phil, cheers, mate.
Cheers.
And it's goodbye from me.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.